anesthesia enthusiasts, and welcome to another episode of Style Points. If you're just joining us for the first time, I'll tell you a little bit about the podcast. We'll start with an RSI, which, of course, stands for Resident Selected Information. This is a short segment at the beginning of the podcast featuring our anesthesiology residents at the University of Cincinnati, where they will present a quick 5-minute anesthesia topic. Next, I'll talk to my colleague, Dr. Brian Vaughn, about his experience working at the Cincinnati Zoo. I'll let my co-host, Chief Resident Nate Moore, introduce our RSI.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to introduce Dr. Morgan Moorhead, one of the interns in our program.
In addition to being the founding member of our department book club, she is a brilliant resident and here to talk to us about whole blood transfusion. Take it away, Morgan.
Thanks, Nate. Today I wanted to discuss the topic of whole blood use during massive transfusion. I was recently on a blood bank rotation that got me interested in the use of whole blood because it's a topic I was personally not very familiar with. Starting broad, what is a massive transfusion? Specific massive transfusion definitions tend to vary slightly at different institutions, but generally, a massive transfusion involves a patient requiring more than 10 units of red blood cells within 24 hours, or replacement of more than half of their total blood volume in 4 hours. Let's set the stage for massive transfusion, but maybe not too graphic. It's 2 a.m. and you get paged to the ED for a trauma. Upon arrival, you see a patient exsanguinating blood from a traumatic MVC. On exam, the patient is tachycardic and hypotensive with delayed capillary refill. They have hemorrhagic shock and they have lost a significant amount of blood. They require resuscitation. Now you as a provider have a choice to make when it comes to their resuscitation. You can do a balanced transfusion or a whole blood transfusion. So let's look further into what a balanced transfusion involves. Let's take a step back first and remember that when patients are bleeding, they aren't losing just their red blood cells, they're also losing their coagulation factors and their platelets. Most of the time, we do a balanced transfusion. This involves replacement of fresh frozen plasma or FFP, platelets, and red blood cells in a 1-to-1-to-1 or 1-to-1-to-2 fashion. Note that the order of the components here is different than how we usually talk about blood products, meaning that in the group of 1-to-1-to-2, for every 1 unit of plasma given, 1 unit of platelets and 2 units of red blood cells will also be given. In the proper study from 2015, there was found to be a significant decrease in the number of patients who died due to exsanguination in the 1-to-1-to-1 group, along with an increase in the number of patients who achieved hemostasis when using this 1-to-1-to-1 protocol. Thus, most practitioners today recommend the use of the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio for massive transfusion. Now, what is a whole blood transfusion? Whole blood transfusions are about as simple as they sound. It's a blood product taken directly from one donor containing red blood cells, platelets, FFP, and cryoprecipitate with a preservative that is added. These products are often group O Rh positive blood with low titers of antibodies to groups A and B. The relatively small pool of potential donors with O negative blood makes it difficult to obtain enough O negative blood for exclusive use in massive transfusion. Instead, most centers use protocols that preferentially give O negative blood in the setting of specific patient demographics, such as women of childbearing age, or they will just exclusively use O positive blood. What are the advantages and disadvantages of whole blood transfusion? One of the advantages of whole blood is the simplification of transfusions. It only takes one bag of whole blood compared to 3 separate bags of components. Likely, these 3 separate bags of components are from 3 different donors when used in the balanced transfusion. Using one bag of whole blood reduces the chance of clerical errors, ABO incompatibility, and a patient's exposure to multiple donors. Whole blood overall is more concentrated in terms of platelets and coagulation factors. Because all of the components are together in whole blood, less preservatives are used overall, and this adds up to being less volume that a total that has to be transfused. Interestingly, platelets in whole blood can be stored cold and actually have better hemostatic function and a longer shelf life than individual room temperature stored platelets. Because the platelets are cold stored, it also decreases the risk of bacterial contamination. What are some of the disadvantages? Some of the disadvantages or concerns with whole blood include the risk for hemolytic transfusion reactions, because type O positive whole blood contains the antibodies to A and B. Generally, this risk is reduced as blood with low titers for these antibodies are preferentially used. Along similar lines, because the blood is Rh positive, you also risk alloimmunization. Consider this when choosing between balanced transfusion and whole blood transfusion for women of childbearing age. Other things to consider with whole blood are more logistics that you wouldn't be thinking of in the moment, including cost of initiating a whole blood program at a blood bank, having enough donors in the already limited type O donor pool, and possible wasting of blood products as whole blood can only be kept for 14 to 21 days. Last, I'd like to talk about the settings you could see whole blood used. Whole blood has often been used in military settings, and it is more often being used in traumas. Other places you may see it used is in the pre-hospital setting with paramedic administration, in OB for postpartum hemorrhage, and possibly in surgeries associated with high blood loss, such as liver transplants or cardiac surgeries. And that is the whole story on whole blood.
Thanks again, Morgan. Today, I have the acute pleasure of welcoming Dr. Brian Vaughn. Brian is an associate professor of anesthesiology here at the University of Cincinnati, and he serves as the director of acute pain and regional anesthesia for the UC Westchester Medical Campus. In addition to his passion for coaching and following soccer, he has also formed a special connection with the Cincinnati Zoo and their veterinary team. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian, I'd like to get to know you just a little bit better, so let me ask you one of my favorite interview questions. If you could have dinner with anyone, including somebody from the past or even from fiction, who would you invite over for dinner and why?
Well, for those that know me and know my passion for soccer, I'm sure they'd be sorely disappointed if I didn't mention someone from soccer. So I'll have to answer that in two parts. First would be Sir Alex Ferguson. He was the amazing manager for Manchester United for over two decades. Just an amazing soccer mind, how he managed the team, how he managed personalities, and really was able to take all sorts of different working parts and make an amazing team. But I think my real answer would really be Albert Schweitzer. He was the reason I went into medicine. He was just an amazing Renaissance man, one of the most intriguing figures of the 20th century. Before he was 30, he was sort of world-renowned in the fields of philosophy, theology, and music. And when he turned 30, he went off to med school, got his degree in medicine, and then went for the next 50 years off to West Africa to be a missionary. He really was an outstanding example of a Christian life, and everything he did, including his philosophy of reverence for life, really pointed to that. And, for all of his service, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He was awarded the British Order of Merit, the French Legion of Honor, really as a sign of respect for all that he did. And it would be really intriguing to have conversations of a wide range of topics with him.
What would you ask him if you had the chance?
Would be interested to see how he came to his philosophy of reverence for life and some of his perspective on Jesus and his life. And how he melded those two things together. Obviously, we both have a common interest in medicine, but really it was a passion for helping other people and following in the command to love thy neighbor of Jesus that I'd really find fascinating.
Well, I appreciate that. Speaking of our neighbors, can you tell us a little bit about your connection with the Cincinnati Zoo and how that came about?
Right. I sort of, got lucky a little bit in that I've always been interested in the outdoors and nature. I'm an Eagle Scout. My son's an Eagle Scout. My wife has degrees in forestry and applied ecology. She's been involved in endangered species management and habitat restoration. So it's really a passion of our families to be in the outdoors, love of nature and things like that. And it just so happened that one of my former partners at Christ Hospital used to do the anesthesia for the zoo. And when he retired from anesthesia and moved to Florida, there was a void there, and he asked me if I'd be interested in doing it. Certainly was not going to say no to that. So it's been a real fun journey to be helping the zoo for the last few years with that.
So what kind of animals have you worked with at the zoo?
It's pretty much exclusively the primates. Basically, you know, the vets are very skilled at doing a lot of things. They're actually quite amazing. I mean, I have a hard enough time keeping track of just one species, where they're taking care of not just primates, but just a sort of a whole range of species, you know, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, and a whole gamut of animals. So it's amazing that they can keep track of it all. But they like us to come there to help them with the primates because they're very human-like. And typically the primates have a little bit more human anesthetic than maybe a typical veterinary anesthetic. And so our expertise allows us to help them with those and also allows them to concentrate more on the care of the animal during the anesthetic if we're able to be there doing the anesthetic.
Now, I would assume that the primates that you're working on aren't having a lot of elective procedures such as cosmetic facelifts and such. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about what types of procedures that these primates are actually having.
Well, it's pretty much, for the most part, routine medical exams and preventative medicine. You're not going to generally have one of these animals submit to, let's say, a chest x-ray and stand in the right position and not interact with the animal training staff or the veterinarians, or, you know, they're wild animals, so they could be unpredictable. So you have to anesthetize them to do what we would consider routine tests for humans. So whether that's looking at their hearts with echocardiography, whether that's doing dental cleanings or other routine sort of preventative maintenance. Or, you know, again, we recently had the gorilla at the zoo break their arm. So they had to be anesthetized to check the x-rays to see if the arm was in fact broken and then come back at a second time to fix the arm.
So how does working with these primates compare to working with human patients? What do you see as some of the differences and challenges that are associated with that?
Yeah, it's really quite similar. I mean, that's why we're involved in terms of a human versus a primate. I think the biggest difference is sort of the communication and the ability for the patient to really understand what we're doing. Obviously, the zoo has a wonderful animal care staff that has a rapport with these animals and does a few things to help us, but they really can't truly understand what we're doing, no matter how much you talk to them or try and explain what you're doing. And that really actually was an interesting conversation I had with head veterinarian there when it came to the arm fracture for Gladys. It was like, what are we going to do for the post-op pain? And on a previous trip to the zoo, they were doing some ultrasound exams. And I said, well, let me borrow the ultrasound and just check. Can I see the brachial plexus, for if we ever needed to do a nerve block in the future? Could I see the femoral and sciatic nerves in the leg if we ever needed to do something in the future to help an animal? And we could see it. But then when we got to talking in this specific case, I was sort of like, well, what's a gorilla going to think if they can't feel their arm? I mean, in one sense, you think, oh, that's great. We're going to preserve the animal from having pain. But on the other hand, like, pain is an evolutionary adaptation, right? It prevents us from doing things that hurt ourselves. So if you can't communicate with an animal to tell them, well, hey, for the next 18, 24 hours, you're not going to feel your arm, what is the animal going to do in response to that? Is it going to start banging its, you know, newly fixed arm against the wall trying to feel it? Is it going to start picking at its fingers or biting its fingers or perhaps harm itself because it can't feel it? Would you not be able to, if the arm was swollen underneath the cast and was causing complications from like blood flow, the animal wouldn't be able to feel it. So, you know, you almost need a little bit of a monitor. So we elected not to do that. But again, that understanding or being able to explain to a patient or get feedback is a lot different. And I think that's where it makes it more challenging.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. That sort of reminds me of how patients who get dental anesthesia can chew on their tongues. Later, of course, they tend to regret doing that.
Yeah, pain is really interesting scientific topic. I mean, that's partly why I got into acute pain. But when I was at Georgetown and I started my career as an orthopedic resident, at Georgetown Med School, we had two of the very rare cases of this syndrome called congenital insensitivity to pain.
Oh, sure.
So there, these two twin boys, like, literally could not feel pain. And they were a wreck because they sit there and wrestle with each other and they dislocate their shoulder and they wouldn't realize it. They'd run around and they'd break their ankle and just keep running around on it. And so they would continuously come back to us at Georgetown for all of these procedures because they couldn't feel pain. And it wasn't anything malicious that we're doing to each other, but the feedback signal of like, that's a bad idea, it wasn't there. So again, that same concept of like trying to do a nerve block would in theory be helpful, but trying to think through all the consequences of your actions is a little tougher with these animals because you don't have that ability either before or after to console, to explain, to give feedback.
Yeah, that certainly is a challenge. So you're called into the zoo for an arm fracture. You go in on one of your days off. What does your day look like? What time do you get there? What sort of steps are you taking? When do you first see the gorilla or primate that you're working with?
Yeah, for the most part, these are scheduled well in advance. I mean, even with the fractured arm, you know, there was communication a number of days in advance, trying to piece together the team. For example, the orthopedic surgeons from Children's Hospital, the anesthesia team from the University of Cincinnati, to get everyone's schedule coordinated, but then also to sort of plan and make sure everything was in place. Because this really is sort of like a human anesthetic. So, for example, we would call our patients beforehand and say, and give them instructions, say, don't eat or drink after this sort of time. So, you know, there's an email that goes out to everyone involved saying, hey, please hold food and water, you know, at this time. We're planning to do the initial injection at this time, the induction at this time. We're planning on, you know, transporting from the enclosure to the veterinary hospital at this time, and sort of an itinerary to make sure that all the various pieces are in place and coordinated. So that includes the animal care team, who's with the animals daily and controls their food, water, and training schedule. Traffic control within the zoo is we have to transport from the enclosure to the veterinary hospital and back and forth, make sure there's not people in our way, all the different pieces to that. So the case really starts a couple of days in advance. Depending on what's going on, we usually start somewhere between, you know, 7 or 8 in the morning with the initial injection of the animal. So obviously they're not going to just sort of walk over to the vet hospital for you and lay down nice on the table while you put in an IV like maybe a human patient would. So typically the animal care team has gotten them trained to accept a hand injection. So we do a little bit of basically sedative medication to get them calmed down before they do like a full intramuscular injection so they don't get startled and hurt themselves from that. And then once they're sedated, then we take them over. So we typically try and start fairly early in the morning so we can get them back to the enclosure in reasonable time.
So have you spoken to the vets about how they train these gorillas to get injections?
A little bit. I mean, it's sort of, it seems, you know, from the outside, I probably won't use the correct term, but very Pavlovian. I mean, it's a reward system. So, you know, you ask an animal or try and get an animal to do a certain behavior, and you reward, you know, that approximation of them. And every time they get closer, you do, you know, serial rewards. So, some of the animals will actually, let you do a few things, you know, obviously inside the animals inside the enclosure, the people doing the procedure or doing the things are outside, but they can safely get them, for example, to extend their hand out through the enclosure to take an a brief injection, or even do, you know, some of the animals, depending on what's going on, you know, maybe you can listen to their heart and lungs a little bit. You can do very, you know, quick looks at the teeth or things like that. They get kind of trained to do that, but it's always a very, you know, careful dance, so to speak.
So as an anesthesiologist, the thing that I think of that I might use in this type of situation is ketamine. Is that the drug that they're using? What kinds of drugs are they using in the veterinary setting for these animals?
Yeah, so a lot of the drugs are very similar. I mean, we're using things like propofol, we're using things like ketamine, we use things like epinephrine. Some of them, because of species differentiation between how like metabolic pathways work, for example, like you can't give ibuprofen to a dog, because the way it gets metabolized, it's toxic to the dog, but other NSAIDs are fine for dogs. So typically, the main medicine that I've you know, worked with them that's different is something called telazol. So basically it's a combination of teletamine, which is a sort of an analog of ketamine, and zolazepam, which is very similar to a benzodiazepine. And so it's like a combination injection that you can give, and that really sedates the animal to the point where you can safely work with them in close proximity, but it's not a respiratory depression. It actually supports respiration, so it's safe to use when to sedate them when you don't have a controlled airway. And then once we do that, then you know we sort of get them moved, and then it becomes more of a human anesthetic at that point.
So how do vets know or test when it's safe to go into the enclosure?
Well, this is sort of a graded process. So again, it's just you start with observation. If they're moving around and looking at you, they're not sedated enough for you to be working with them. You know, so gradually they kind of go off to sleep. But then you use some stimulation from a safe distance. You know, typically maybe a long piece of material that you can, you know, kind of tap the animal from outside the enclosure to make sure there's not a reaction. And you make sure that, you know, they're not reacting to that. And then there's some safety doors to get into these enclosures rather than the main door. So we'll have some of the staff go in one of the safety doors, ready to quickly get out if, for example, the animal responds to the human presence rather than just sort of a poke, for lack of a better word.
Safety strikes me as one of the critically important concerns here, not just for the patient, so to speak, but for everyone involved. I think most people listening are probably aware of the relative strength of a gorilla being just wildly out of proportion as compared to what one might expect from a human. So what sort of safety precautions do you take into consideration, whether it's during transport or anything else?
Yeah, a lot of it's communication and redundancy. So for example, there's multiple locks on the doors. There's multiple doors that separate enclosures from, let's say, the animal side to the human side or the exterior. So like when we're interacting with the animal, there's multiple levels there. I think the most important team is the wonderful animal care team and staff at the zoo that really form a rapport with these animals. And I mean, they're amazingly dedicated. They're wonderful people. They spend an enormous amount of time working with these creatures. And really, they're like their family. And just, I think, their ability to, whether it's their soothing voice, because obviously they don't understand words necessarily, but just a soothing voice, their presence, their calming reassurance, when we either starting the process to get an animal sedated or emerging them out of an anesthetic, that really provides a level of safety, both for the animal, but also for us, that they're not getting excited. They're not feeling threatened. And I think that's probably the biggest safety piece. There always is, you know, what they call the DART team at the zoo, the Dangerous Animals Response Team, that is always available and on call if an animal interaction would go awry, or if, for example, an animal was able to get out of an enclosure. I mean, that's basically back in around 2016, what happened with Harambe and the unfortunate outcome there with the child. But
the Harambe event was, of course, very tragic for everyone involved. Let's talk a little bit about some of the techniques and equipment that might be different. At what point are we putting in a breathing tube? At what point are we putting in an IV? How does that whole process look?
Right, I guess I'll just kind of start at the beginning and work our way through. And a lot of it's very similar. I mean, I think that kind of your biggest differences are you're not going to put in a wake IV to do a traditional IV induction. You don't really get to sit there and have pre-oxygenation, for example. And then the emergence piece as well, like you've got to safely get out the breathing tube. So you got to make sure the airway is safe to remove that tube. But you also don't really want to be in the enclosure to remove the tube once they're too awake. So it's a little bit of a dance there. So I think the sort of the induction emergence is the biggest challenge and difference, that you're going to have to do that differently than humans. The other piece is the movement. Like, we typically don't put a person to sleep in one place and then put them in some sort of a transport vehicle and move them to another place to do the surgery and then put them back in a transport vehicle to go to the recovery room. So that's a bit of a challenge. You know, you want them sedated enough. Obviously you don't want too much, but then you gotta, with the team, pick them up on a stretcher, get them into the back of a van that has a mobile anesthesia machine in it. There's basically an open circuit anesthesia machine, to continue to start the process of giving them gas to keep them asleep. We always have ketamine on backup, to do some IM injections, get them to the veterinary hospital, pick them up again, get them into the facility. And then that's where sort of what most people would say is, oh, there's a human anesthesia machine there. And it looks like a mostly human anesthesia machine. There's some differences in terms of the pressures it can generate, the volumes it can generate just because of the size of these animals. The bag, the reservoir bag is significantly larger because especially like, for example, the orangutans have enormous lungs. So it's actually have like a wide piece and two big breathing bags on there. Yeah, so getting them in there, but then it becomes very human. You know, the patient's sedated, we put in an IV, we give them a little extra propofol perhaps to get them more deeply anesthetized to do a regular direct laryngoscopy to get an endotracheal tube, but the tube's obviously bigger, the laryngoscope is bigger.
Do you recall what size breathing tube you were using?
Yeah, a lot of times it's like a 10 or 11, whereas, you know, an adult human male might be an 8. So it's significantly different. Obviously they have much bigger tubes for things like giraffes, for example, which are interesting to see. But yeah, that's kind of where the difference is, induction, emergence, and then the transport. But again, the anesthesia machine is very similar. The vital signs are very similar. The medications for the most part are very similar that you're going to use. So sort of the middle of the anesthetic is very similar.
So if I have this right, you're transporting the gorilla. Is it you with a vet in the back of the van?
Right. There's kind of a team that goes over. So it's one of those, you know, large, you know, you could probably have four or five rows of seats in it. It's sort of a van. So there's always, you know, three or four people in the van that are helping with the transport, just physically lifting some of these animals that can be, you know, 300-400 pounds. But then behind that seat for the back half of the van, there's a, you know, mobile open circuit anesthesia machine bolted to the floor. And then usually myself and then one of the other vets are in the back, or one of the other UC physicians, anesthesiologists, are in the back monitoring the primate to make sure they're staying asleep and make sure they're breathing and not obstructing.
How does it feel being in the back of a van with a, say, 200, 300 pound gorilla? It's an experience very few people in the world must have had. What's going on in your mind when the gorilla coughs or moves?
Well, luckily, most of the time they don't. We do a lot of testing to make sure they're properly sedated. But again, we do have intramuscular ketamine to give them additional sedation if we need to. But certainly, yeah, well, every once in a while they do move a little bit. They cough, they hiccup. It does give you a little bit of moment of pause there, sort of. You know, not to date myself, but back to the Tom and Jerry cartoons, you know, sometimes, you know, you see them get into a fight inside of a sort of a closed space, whether that was like a tent or a vehicle or whatever. And you can see the vehicle being dented with, you know, images of Tom or Jerry from the inside, you know, as it gets tossed around. So that kind of goes through your head sort of humorously. But, you know, you're safe. The vets do a wonderful job. They know what they're doing. They're very professional and wonderful to work with. So I'm not really concerned that they're going to wake up, but it does run through your mind.
That definitely seems like an intense situation to be in.
Yeah, I certainly have to pay attention.
I wonder if you can share with us some of your most memorable experiences working with the primates at the zoo.
Well, certainly. I think the most memorable will always be the first one. You know, when you first have an opportunity to come close to one of these amazing primates. So the first one I did was in Dume. He's the silverback at the zoo. So obviously a very large gorilla. And it's just, you know, you see them from a distance and you appreciate the beauty and the majesty of the large primates. But when you see them up close and see really how human-like they are, like especially the eyes, the hands, and things like that, you really gain a really deep appreciation for their beauty. And it was just amazing. And I think each time you take care of, let's say, a different species. So the first time I did an orangutan, the first time I did a bonobo, just seeing the differences between them, but also, again, especially the bonobos, which is genetically our closely related primate, and more physically sized like a human, you know, You're like, wow, this is sort of like a close relative, you know, and things.
I bet that's really fascinating. You know, it strikes me that you might not be able to use normal EKG stickers on primates. Do the EKG stickers work?
They can use some tricks to get them to work. They can shave a little area of the skin to get them to work. They also have some modified EKG electrodes to use to be able to get the EKG. But again, if you look at the monitor that we're using, it looks very much like one of the monitors we've had on top of our anesthesia machine. And the pulse ox looks very similar, for example. The blood pressure cuff is identical. So there's not a lot of difference there.
So really, we're using the same monitors?
Essentially, yes. Yeah, we monitor end tidal CO2. We monitor frequent blood pressure, frequent heart rate, as we always do.
You also mentioned that they do cardiac exams. Is that something that translates over in the same sort of way?
Yeah, certainly. And that's one of the things that I think when you ask about challenges and differences, it is learning some of the differences in anatomy, physiology, and disease processes for some of these different species. For example, like the large primates typically have a problem getting accelerated cardiac disease, and not necessarily coronary artery disease, but they typically are at higher risk for getting valvular disease and also lethal dysrhythmias. So one of the things that they do is they do frequent echocardiograms to monitor their heart function, their valve status. Interestingly enough, they bring a echo tech from one of the local hospitals over, and they bring their PE machine, and it looks exactly like pretty much like a human heart. But they do that, but they also, for example, in one of these sort of multi-zoo collaborations, are actually doing a study on these dysrhythmias. So we've actually, as part of that study to improve the ability of these animals to live and survive, they've actually implanted loop monitors, like basically human, cardiac monitoring loop recorders into these animals to study the incidence of dysrhythmias or what's happening and why they're at risk for these lethal dysrhythmias. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't suppose a Holter monitor would be of much use in the gorilla pen.
It would probably not stay on very long. I mean, going back to Gladys, the gorilla with the broken arm, I mean, they sort of had to do a more robust fixation than maybe would be typically done for a human, but also there was some involvement in GE and local aviation to use some different materials with the brace and cast the gorilla that would be a little more sturdy for her recovery.
Yeah, I imagine so. So you've gone through the anesthetic, it's time for emergence. What's different about the emergence process? I know you described it as a bit of a dance. Tell me more.
Right. So in a typical human, we would just, for majority of cases, turn off the gas at the appropriate time, wait for the patient to exhale enough gas that the level of gas within their brain drops to the point where they become conscious again. They get conscious enough to protect their airway and be awake enough to not hurt themselves. And we take out the breathing tube and transfer them to the recovery room. Obviously, you don't want a primate to be fully awake before A, transporting them, or B, being in the room with them. So basically, we're modifying their level of anesthesia to give us time to transport the animal. So we'll pretty much leave the gas at their maintenance level so that we know that we have time to transport the animal. And then again, we leave the IV in during transport so that we could give some additional medication, whether it was propofol or ketamine, to keep them sedated if the gas doesn't last as long as we think it might. Obviously, just like humans, the longer you're in a procedure, the longer it takes to get rid of the gas. So if we have some shorter procedures, sometimes we need to supplement it because the gas comes off quicker. If they're longer procedures, then oftentimes we can just rely on the gas. So that's basically it. But then the emergence portion of it, we don't want these animals to hurt themselves either accidentally because they're not aware of what they're doing or they're startled. And so we take them back to their enclosure in a very padded environment that the care team has gotten set up for us. So we give them a nice soft place to emerge from. And then we monitor them carefully when they're awake enough to get the tube out and protect their airway, we take it out, but then we still monitor them from outside the enclosure to make sure they're breathing properly, not obstructing, they're waking up in a safe fashion. They might be a little clumsy, a little awkward, just like anyone would be when they're waking up. If you've ever seen your dog at the vet come out from being sedated, you see they're a little clumsy. So you see that. I mean, they're not just going to sit nicely on a stretcher or a bed like people do.
Well, not all people do.
Well, this is true. We try to keep them in the bed as best we can. But you know, that's the challenge, is to get them awake and let them wake up in a fashion that they don't feel startled or threatened. And again, that animal care team that's there is a huge benefit because those animals trust those people and they're reassured by them. So they do a great job.
So when we're dealing with human patients, there's a whole set of ethics we're used to thinking about and using. As anesthesiologists, we're used to treading these waters. Are there different ethical considerations for these primates versus our human patients?
Obviously, they're not people. But I think we still follow the same ethical rules that we do with people. I mean, we treat them with respect. We don't joke around. We give them the best care possible. We're not taking frivolous pictures to post on social media. And the other piece of it is, I mean, we're basically doing these for routine exams. We're doing these anesthetics for preventative health maintenance. Occasionally for an injury, an illness, some sort of infection where the animal needs help. So we're not doing anything controversial. We're just maintaining the health of these animals. So there's not really much in the way of ethical considerations here. I think it gets a lot more complicated when you get into the host of issues that humans choose or to do or not do certain procedures or use certain technologies in healthcare. But I think it's a little more straightforward, actually.
Let's say that you met with a young anesthesiologist who was really interested in pursuing this sort of exotic type of anesthesia. Do you have any advice for how they might go about partnering with their local zoo?
Like I said before, it wasn't something I planned, so I don't have this great pathway that I took to say, these are the three steps that you should take. I would just offer that the vets at these zoos are incredibly dedicated professional people. And I'm sure they would be happy for additional help or expertise. So my advice would only be to reach out to your local zoo and talk to the vets and see if there's anything you could do to help. Can't hurt. The worst they can do is say is no, but they might very well be very happy to have your help.
How do you feel about the teamwork with the vets that you experience at the Cincinnati Zoo?
Well, it's a great team. I mean, you see how much they care for these animals, the interactions between the vets and the animal care team, but even the people like the animal safety officers or even the people who are maintaining traffic flow at the zoo, they really do care for these animals and they're really looking to do the best for them. I think that's the value that we add. They could do these anesthetics without us. I think they feel more comfortable with us there because of our expertise, since they're sort of like humans. But more importantly, when we're there, we are focused on the safety of these animals during their anesthetic, which allows the vets who have the expertise to take care of these animals to focus on that and not have to worry about the anesthetic as well and either divide their attention or divide the work taking care of the animal, which means then the animal's under anesthesia longer, which, you know, as with humans, the longer you're under anesthesia, although anesthesia is very safe, there's more risk to the longer procedures. And some of these animals have some issues. Some of the primates have heart failure. Some of them have valve disease. And so the anesthetic for them is challenging. And the quicker you get done with those exams or treatments, the better it is for the animal. So that's where I think the teamwork comes together and they appreciate us being there. And it's great to be part of that team.
So since the vet's attention isn't divided, they don't have to do all the things at once. They're able to more efficiently do the things that they need to do and therefore minimize the time under anesthesia and minimize the risk to these primates.
Exactly.
I really appreciate you sharing your experience working with the Cincinnati Zoo and some of the unique challenges that you face in that environment. Before I let you go, though, I'd like to ask you about your own personal style points. What style points or points of personal preference have brought you success, both in and out of the operating room?
I think for me, it's really important to be personable, to be kind, not take myself too seriously, have a good sense of humor. As an anesthesiologist, I think a lot of people from the outside think we go into anesthesia because we don't want to talk to patients, right, or we can't talk to patients. However, these patients are at one of the most vulnerable points of their lives. They literally have to trust us with their life. And we get a very small window of opportunity to be able to talk to these people, meet them before we accept that responsibility. So I think it's really important to be able to make that connection, whether that's with a kind word, a little bit of a story, one of my famous dad jokes, that just puts them at ease, but allows them to feel cared for and trusting, to be able to kind of put them at ease, more importantly than using medication to do that, for example. I think that's true with our coworkers at our hospital as well. I mean, the hospital is by definition a very stressful place to work at. So if you can make people feel valued for their work, a kind word, not making them feel pressured, the whole system's going to work better. And that's the same, I feel like, as a coach and as a parent. It's amazing how well someone can work or play or live with the confidence or ease that they are put at by treating them well, being kind to them, giving them that empathetic kind word, or even just a laugh.
Okay, so now I have to ask, hit me with your best dad joke.
Well, since we're talking about the zoo, I'll go with the one that I used at the zoo, and I sort of try and put my fellow anesthesiologists at ease the first time they come. And they're always talking, they see people taking, some pictures of the experience so that they can kind of, educate other people and things. And there's always a question about, privacy and different things. And I always tell people that luckily, because we're at the zoo, we're not governed by federal privacy acts. But we do, even though we don't take care of them, they're very careful with Fiona and her family and their privacy, because we wouldn't want to commit an accidental HIPAA violation.
Excellent. HIPAA violation. I will remember that. Well, Brian, thank you again for joining us and sharing your insights. I really appreciate you and your point of view.
Appreciate you having me.
Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of Style Points. If you liked what you heard, there's more to come. While our previous episodes have focused on some difficult anesthetic cases, such as liver transplant, pheochromocytoma, and obstetric cardiac anesthesia, or Dr. Arabal's excellent rundown of GLP-1 agonists, we have more in the works, including anesthesia for ECMO and a mock oral board scenario given by a real board examiner. Search your favorite podcast app on your phone for Style Points, and it should come up under my name, John Crow. Once again, thanks for joining us. Take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We're all done.